welcome to another episode of Magic the Prothering.
That's right. This is episode number 4 of Magic the Prothering, yes. As they all are.
They're all episode 4.
They're all episode 4.
It's really interesting how our numbering system works so very well.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes you have to shake things up a little bit.
And Magic the Prothering is brought to you by you, the people. The people of the world. And anybody who supports us on patreon.com/mtacast. It's kind of a reward, a way to say thank you for being supporters. And of course, we have to thank our other sponsor, Card Kingdom.
That's right, cardkingdom.com/mtacast, a great place to pick up all of your singles, boosters, and magic, etc., etc.
So the point behind Magic the Prothering is to invite pro players on and just kind of ask them about their life in Magic. Go deep into their existence as a Magic player and find out more about who they are, why they love the game, and how they're so gosh darn good at it.
That's right. And Maria, who are we going to get to learn more about today?
Today we are welcoming to the Prothering very special guest, William Huey Jensen. Welcome!
Hi!
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being on the show. We're so excited.
So I'm going to embarrass you a little bit by reading off some of your stats over the years, just in case anybody doesn't know who you are. First of all, get out from under your rock. Second of all, listen to this list. Okay, so Huey won Pro Tour Boston in 2003, has finished in the top 8 of 4 additional Pro Tours.
He has 21 Grand Prix top 8s and 4 Grand Prix wins.
In 2013, voted in to the Hall of Fame.
And he is the current record holder of the most Grand Prix top 8 finishes in a single season, with 8 of them in 2013-2014.
Oh my gosh. That's like insane.
That's not embarrassing.
That's right. He's not Minnesotan. In Minnesota, if someone says something nice about you, you have to act embarrassed.
Yeah, that's true.
The rest of the world, it's like, you can be proud of your accomplishments. That's an awesome list.
That's so true. Like, when you hear that, does that sound surreal to you at all? Or are you like, yeah, no, I worked for that?
Honestly, I think it's somewhat the latter. Like, I try, you know, that's a long, long time. That's 20 years worth of work there. It's not so much like, yeah, okay, when, you know, top 8 Grand Prix in a season, that was a bit lucky. But overall, I put in a lot of time and a lot of effort to achieve those stats. So I'm definitely proud of it. But I wouldn't say it feels surreal. Not anymore.
So you've been playing Magic for a really long time, and you were playing back in what I call the days of the Wild West of Magic. You started, how old were you when you started, and why did you get into Magic?
So the summer after 7th grade. So it would have been the summer of 1995, so I would have been 12 turning 13. And one day I went into school towards the end of 7th grade, and the teacher handed out like a pamphlet or whatever about a camp, but it was not a normal camp. It was like a camp for smart kids, and it had all kinds of stuff that I thought was really cool, like chess and magic, but not Magic the Gathering, like actually like you learn magic tricks and, you know, like a fantasy adventures. They called them classes, but it was more like, you know, different activities, like effectively a D&D class, and it just sounded like the coolest thing ever to me. So I signed up for the camp, and I went. And the first day I got there, all the kids were playing Magic. So naturally, a 12 or 13-year-old boy, I wasn't going to be the only one who wasn't doing this thing. So I went after camp, and I went to the store and got some Magic cards and started working on my deck. And I decided I was going to play Black. And over, you know, the rest of summer camp, I started playing Magic, but let's just say by the camp next year, it wasn't too competitive anymore.
Yeah. So how did you get involved in the tournament scene, from going to playing at a Magic camp to becoming sort of putting your toe into the water of the professional Magic career?
So basically, I had friends at camp who would play the occasional tournament, and I started going to a store called Treasure Chest. On Saturdays, it was maybe half an hour, 40 minutes from my house. And they had a Type 1 tournament, which vintage now, every Saturday. But they had a junior division. So I played the junior division for a while. It was really hard to be competitive. Most of the older guys had, you know, all the power cards and the very expensive cards. So there was almost no way to be competitive. But then over time, people people sort of took notice of me and they thought I played well. So what would happen was occasionally people would start loaning me decks for like a small cut of the prize with like a full decked out type one deck. This was like, you know, halfway through the year. And so I would just play their deck and I would always win when I had the better cards in addition to just like probably being the better player. I mean, it's hard to say how good I was at 12 or 13. I guess by then I was 13, but and then so I would give them a little bit of the prize, and that was kind of
like
neat.
Race.
I was going to say it's like race horses.
Yeah, exactly.
Where people are like, "This is a good sure money, good bet."
Exactly. And then I was able to use the store credit. I was able to use the store credit to amass my own Type 1 stuff, but actually, it all got stolen when I was at Pro Tour Rome, so that was too bad.
Oh, I know. Gosh. Oh, I bet there's some expensive stuff in there, too.
It would be worth a lot today, although it's unlikely I would still have it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Whoa. That's crazy. So, speaking of, how old were you at, was Pro Tour Rome your first Pro Tour?
Yeah, Pro Tour Rome was probably a few years later, right? I don't remember the exact date. I'm guessing 98. Could have been 99. I suppose there's an outside shot it was 97, but let's call it 98. I was probably 16 or 17. 15 or 16. I think I was 16.
Yeah, that would have been 98.
Yeah, I think I was 16. And I had been playing, by this point, I had been playing at TJ Collectibles in their extended tournament every Saturday for a year, year and a half. And I effectively won that tournament every Saturday, and my rating got really good. So I qualified for Rome on rating.
What the heck is that? Like, does that still happen?
Yeah,
no.
No, they don't have ratings anymore. They used to have like a type 2 rating, a type 1 rating, extended rating, like maybe even, I don't remember if sealed and draft were one or if it was just limited, or if we're separate, if it was just one limited rating. But depending on the format of the Pro Tour, you needed a different rating to qualify for it. And then you had like a composite rating that you could qualify for like nationals and worlds with. And so Rome was the first extended Pro Tour, I think. And I had a very, very good extended rating. There were so few tournaments, I got to play one every weekend. And so I headed to Italy. My mom and my sister went. I was still too young, or at least perceived to be too young, to travel alone. And I didn't do very well at the tournament, but I did have fun.
Oh, that would be an amazing experience when you're 16.
Yeah.
So that Pro Tour is kind of renowned for having a deck in the field that could win on turn one, which was the Tolarian Academy deck. Now, you weren't playing that deck. Can you talk about a little bit about what it was like to like have, first of all, that deck in a standard or in the environment of the Pro Tour, and then what deck you were playing? Because yours seemed pretty cool, too.
Yeah. So, you know, man, those decks back then were just stupid. I mean, when I think about it, like every deck in that format was so broken. The Academy deck was just a bunch of artifacts, Tolarian Academy, Time Spiral, Stroke of Genius. Some people had really good versions with like Lion's Eye Diamonds and Yawgmoth's Wills. But I think in general, it was just mono blue or maybe blue red for Gorilla Shaman for the mirror and stuff. But you have to think like Mox Diamond was legal, Tolarian Academy was legal, Mana Vault was legal, Voltaic Key was legal. I mean, you literally would get draws where you'd go Mox Diamond, discard a land, Tolarian Academy, Mana Vault, Voltaic Key, Time Spiral. And then you'd be like, I'll play another Mox Diamond, play a Mana Vault, Windfall. And I mean, you would see 30 cards before your opponent got to put a land into play. And yeah, it was just out of control. There were some cards back then, some sideboard cards like Arcane Laboratory, which is just Rule of Law but blue, Energy Flux, some really, really impactful cards. But I mean, Tolarian Academy and Mana Vault in the same deck is out of control. I personally played a deck that was based around Great Whale. If people don't know what Great Whale is, it's a 7-mana 5/5 when it comes into play, untap 7 lands. It's a bit like Palancron, but it doesn't have an innate, an inherent ability to return itself to your hand, to its owner's hand. But 7-mana when it comes into play, untap 7 lands, and recurring Nightmare. So, if you get four lands into play, and then you get either two Great Whales or a Great Whale and a Priest of Gix or a Great Whale and like a Peregrine Drake or something that untaps more than three lands, you just make infinite mana. And then there are some cool ways to win. You could win with like Stroke of Genius, or you could recur Triskelion infinite times. Or the coolest way was probably once you were going through the loop, you could activate a Mishra's Factory and use Great Whale to keep untapping it and pump itself infinite times. The cool part about that deck was you had access to blue and black mana, so in theory, it was good about fighting the Academy deck. I actually copied the deck from Dave Humphreys, who was sort of like my Magic idol growing up, and he had played it in a local tournament, so I just basically copied his deck. That was how I tested for that tournament. And I think he got ninth. I'm not 100% sure, but I think we were the only two people that played the deck, to the best of my knowledge. I ended up not doing that well. I didn't make day two, and he got ninth. So his version was almost certainly better. Like, he had had time to tune it, and I basically just went with what he had played a month or month and a half earlier at the local tournament.
Very cool. So, speaking of, like, there was no Magic Online back then. There wasn't really, you know, like, all of the sites now that compile lists that have been doing well at tournaments. So how did you prepare for a Pro Tour, and how did you put together decks?
Well, for that one, I just had two friends who were also qualified, and we would just play, and we would just, like, try stuff ourselves. Right about that time is when the Dojo, which was like the first Magic site, started becoming popular, but there was no trove of information, especially for a format that there hadn't been a tournament of yet. After tournaments, people started writing tournament reports and you could get deck lists, but it was nothing like today. I mean, you just had to find a friend, go somewhere, put physical decks together and play, and that's what you did. So for that Pro Tour, I didn't test much. After that, I was fortunate enough to grow up in an area with a lot of really, really good Magic players, the Boston area, and a lot of the older guys and, you know, the seasoned pros. I was fortunate enough that they were nice enough and they liked me enough to let me prepare with them until sort of I made a name for myself, and then I ended up working with mostly like Ben Rubin and Casey McCarroll and the Californians for a while after that.
So I'm kind of interested in that sort of time period of Magic when you're going and experimenting and there's not this online resource to tell you what's the best deck, what sideboard card should you bring or something like that. How do you feel playing the game nowadays as opposed to playing then? Do you feel that there was more of a spirit of invention back then and it was exciting? Or do you prefer nowadays when it's kind of easier to test and to find new strategies?
Oh, I prefer back then for sure. I thought it was so cool. Like, it's really cool to show up for a Pro Tour and you either have a deck or you see a deck that you hadn't thought of, or you have the deck that nobody else thought of and you play against it or somebody plays against you, and it's just like somebody has come up with something so advanced that you almost can't win. I think that's cool. I think it's not so exciting when it's like I show up to the Pro Tour with my Abzan deck and you're playing the Jeskai deck that I played 100 hours against before the tournament, and I know it's a 51-49 matchup. It's fine. I mean, it has its pros and cons, certainly, right? But I sort of liked the era of innovation, if you will.
Which is now a card.
Excellent, excellent. I also love drawing three cards.
Don't we all?
Do you?
Yeah, I prefer to just
all right.
Smash people in the face, but, you know.
Fair enough, fair enough. So like we said, that was in 98, was Pro Tour Rome. And then in around 2004, you decided to retire. And then you came back about 8 years later. So what made you decide to retire, and then what made you decide to come back?
Well, in 2003, I had a really, really good calendar year. Like, it wasn't all encompassed in one pro season, but over the course of 12 months around that time, I made 3 Pro Tour top eights, and I won the Pro Tour in Boston with Matt Lindy and Brock Parker as a team Pro Tour. Part of it was like I started becoming interested in other things, and I am not very good at managing my time. Like, if I'm interested in something, that's what I want to be doing, and that's basically all I want to be doing. For large periods of time in my life, that's been Magic, which is great, but around that time, other stuff caught my attention, and I sort of felt like, you know, I just had this season where I made 3 Pro Tour top eights. I won a Pro Tour. Like, what am I trying to prove now? Like, the competition with myself sort of ended. Like, I won. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You can always win more, but For me personally, I always need to have that chip on my shoulder, or I just can't, like, if I don't care more about winning than anything, it's hard for me to give it my all. So I just wanted to try some other stuff. You know, part of it too is that was a 2004. I turned 22, 23, and I'm starting, you know, to think long term, and it's like, all right, I do okay playing Magic, but maybe there's something to be said for finding a career that could be potentially a little more lucrative. Certainly it's great to do what you love, but like I said, I was enjoying other stuff. So, around 2012, I missed getting in the Hall of Fame by one vote.
Oh, God. Daggers.
And so they gave me an invite to Pro Tour Return to Ravnica, a special invite. And I showed back up and I got on the team, which it's evolved a bit, effectively now known as Pantheon. A previous iteration of that team, because I was still friends with Finkel and others from my time on the Pro Tour. So fortunately, I have the luxury of just, you know, showing up for my first Pro Tour in 7 years and getting on the best team. And I instantly reconnected with a lot of old friends and made a lot of new friends. And I remember leaving Seattle just going, you know, thinking to myself, well, this is what I want to be doing again, so this is what I should be doing. And lo and behold, I came back. I made a ton of new friends. I'm loving playing Magic, and also Magic has just grown 10,000%, seemingly. Like, you know, the first Grand Prix Vegas, I walked in, and I'll never forget the feeling. Like, I had played some Grand Prix as a kid, as a teenager, whatever, with like 240 people. I walked into Vegas, the first one, and I was almost speechless. I walked over to Scott Larrabee and I sort of told him, like, this is the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen. I think a lot of people take for granted, or even not take for granted, people, you know, dislike how big the tournaments are and whatever. Certainly I understand there's some pros and cons to it, but the popularity of Magic is clearly a huge pro. And for people who hadn't lived it, when you show up at a tournament and it's 200 to 260 people, I don't think it's easy to understand, like, how awe-inspiring it can be to see something like these Vegas tournaments that are getting 5 and 10,000 people. It's just surreal. That's surreal to me.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. I mean, not literally.
You've been there.
So. I was at Vegas. It's like your mom gets married to a new guy. You go off to college. You come back from college. She has two kids.
You described my life, but I'll vouch for the fact that it is a little weird. It is a little weird.
It's a smaller scale. So you were probably in a good position to kind of see, besides how the game had exploded with its popularity, how the game had changed since you had been playing in the early days and when you came back.
So what do you think are some of the most notable differences? What, besides the size of tournaments, really struck you coming back?
Well, I sort of struggled with this for the first year. It's just a much different game. In general, the creatures are a lot more powerful than they were in my day. Back when I played originally, it was all about the spells. The spells were much better than the creatures. In fact, like, you go to tournaments and people who played creature decks, you almost felt like they couldn't beat you. The creatures just weren't good enough. And so when I came back, I remember I was just playing way too conservatively, just trying to, like, maximize too many situations, not take enough risks. And it's just not the way Magic is played anymore. You basically have to just, like, cast your most expensive spell every turn. The sweepers aren't good enough. The creature removal's not good enough. You don't really need to hold anything for anything. And it's, you know, once in a while, you get the really good games where cards line up perfectly and there's a ton of little decisions. But a higher majority of the games just come down to draws, in my opinion. Mm. Not draws like running out of time. Draws as in, like, opening hands or whatever. And certainly just the strategies in general are different. Like, you know, one of the most popular decks when I was playing before was a deck that was literally something like 26 land, 30 counter spells, and 4 Venerable's Discs, which is a 4-mana artifact sweeper. And it's like, a deck like that just couldn't function anymore. There's no way. And I think it's probably for the better. I think that's a bit too extreme. I don't think anybody wants to play a game where their opponent's strategy is literally to counter every single spell they cast for the entire game. I mean, that's a bit extreme, too, on the other end. no land destruction strategies anymore. And a lot of the more broken cards, just type effects, tutor effects, they're all really weak and have been slowly phased out.
Yeah, and we just had a blog post recently from Mark Rosewater, who was essentially like, well, if you're looking for the good old days of Drago Magic, you can go sit over in that corner and wait another 100 years.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. I mean, you know, there's a reason, you know, they're running a business, and certainly I would love to play Turbo Stasis once in a while, but there's a reason Magic has grown 1,000% or whatever in popularity over the past several years, and that's Planeswalkers and Siege Rhino and Mantis Riders, so... I appreciate what they're doing, and seems to be working.
Sorry, I don't
care what Siege Rhino has done for the game. It can go to hell. It can go straight to hell.
I just
not
really
my favorite either.
I really want to make a movie called Turbo Stasis. It's definitely set in space.
Yes, and it has something to do with people. I think I was just going to describe passengers.
Yeah, it's
I
basically
think I was
passengers.
Just describe yep. Passengers. Yep. Never mind. That idea is already done. All right.
So this is just kind of a broad question, but you've had such a long history from the game, going away, coming back. Why do you love playing Magic? What keeps you interested still to this day?
Mostly it's the people. At times it's always like, yeah, I just want to sit down and have a battle of wits with somebody and, you know, have some... contests. Like, some people like to arm wrestle, and some people like to play football, and some people like to play chess. The way I always wanted to sort of compete was through playing Magic, and that just happened to be my outlet. I think Magic's a great game. I think it's the best game ever created by in terms of my level of enjoyment. But what definitely keeps me coming back through all the years and all the time is the people in the community, no doubt. You know, when I've played enough Magic tournaments now. For the most part, like when I get on a plane and I'm going to a Grand Prix to play Modern, I'm not like, oh, I can't wait to see, you know, if I can go 13-2 with this Jun deck for the 800th time. It's more like, you know, I really can't wait to see Reed and Andrew and Owen and John and Brock and whomever else.
So that's, well, first that's of all, so, that's so nice. You were talking before about how you need to have that chip on your shoulder or something to shoot for. And you've had so much success. So what does that goal for you now look like?
I think at this point, I hope that I can instill that in other people. You know, I hope to do well, but I you know, I've become more involved in doing coverage, and I think I'm just mellowing out in my old age. I'm hoping that I can, you know, help my teammates, especially my younger teammates who aspire to you know, to be great and to win all the tournaments. And I try to be there and sort of set an example, give advice, be a mentor, really, I feel is more my role in things these days than sort of trying to win every tournament myself.
Will you be our mentor?
Sure.
We need help.
Now, Maria, you sit down and you listen to him, okay?
Okay.
Are you going to do well at this tournament?
I don't know.
Well, what do you need to do?
I need to talk to Huey.
You need to listen to your mentor. what's your favorite format to play these days?
Any team format is always my favorite. I find it, the team tournaments are the ones that can still sort of get the, almost no matter what format, no matter where I were playing or who I were playing with, although it's always Owen and Reed at this point, is... that gets me to make sure, like, I really don't want to do anything wrong when other people are counting on me. When it's like, if I mess up, it's like, okay, you messed up, whatever. But if I have to face somebody else and, like, my mistake or my shortcomings cost them something that they want or something tangible to them, that I can't handle. So the team tournaments, they sort of, like, inherently get me to have that chip on my shoulder that I was talking about before. So it's always been that way for me. I hate to let other people down. I hate to let myself down too, but even less, you know, even more so is letting somebody else down. So any team tournament, they're also just more fun. It's just way more fun to go to a tournament and like sit there with your friends all weekend and try to beat people and make jokes than just sit there, you know, by yourself playing one-on-one all weekend. So it's always been team tournaments. It's team tournaments now. It'll always been it'll always be team tournaments for
sure. Yeah, you get more of that pressure, but you also get more reward.
Yeah.
Like when you when you do well and when they do well, it's so much more enjoyable, I think.
It's way more fun. It's way more fun to win a team tournament. Like I've won individual tournaments, I've won team tournaments. It's like exponentially more fun to win a team tournament. I assume it's like every experience in life. It's just much better when you share it with somebody.
Yeah, like eating a good waffle.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Man. That's what I was thinking.
Yes. We were all thinking it, right? We were all thinking eating waffles.
And you're pretty good at team draft, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, there was a period of time. I'm not saying this is true, but there was a period of time where I think it was I was probably the consensus best player at Team Rochester Draft, or the best drafter at Team Rochester Draft. And I think also I'm pretty highly regarded at Team Booster Draft, because that's what we used to do for fun. We used to just do team drafts at the Pro Tours after you know, day two was over, or if we didn't do too well after day one was over, we'd just team draft all weekend, because that was always the most fun format. So a lot of us, like me, Finkel, Ben Stark, people have been playing for 15, 18, 20 years. We tend to be pretty good at that format, just because we've played so much of it compared to even the, you know, the top players now who happen to have not been playing for quite as long.
And Rochester is similar, except that you can see everybody's picks. Was that it?
Yeah, Rochester Draft was basically like you only draft one pack at a time. So imagine we were playing 3-on-3. We'd have my team on one side of the table, 3 in a row, and your team on one side of the table, the other 3 in a row. And so if I'm in the center, we would start with my pack. So I would take a card, then my teammate to my left would take a card, and then it would just go clockwise until it got to the player to my right, who would take 2 cards, and it would bounce back. And you would do that for every all 18 packs. Like the second pack would start with the player to my left. That player would open a pack. It would go clockwise around to me and bounce back. And then the player to his left would open a pack, and so on and so forth.
That's just crazy.
That is so weird.
It took a long time. That's one of the problems with it. For day two of the Pro Tour, you'd do 4 Rochester drafts. 4 or 5 rounds of Rochester draft, but every time you'd have to do a new draft. So it'd be like an hour of the draft, an hour of the match, plus deck construction every time. So that's part of why they phased it out.
Holy cow, yeah, wow. That would just take ages.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah.
But it sounds amazing.
It was slow, but it was awesome, yeah.
So speaking of teams, you're a member of, I would say, the most prominent team out there, Peach Garden Oath. And just let everybody in on the secret. Did you make an oath in a Peach Garden or what?
So I'll tell you what the Peach Garden Oath is. Some people know that, some people don't. If you've ever seen the card Peach Garden Oath from Portal Three Kingdoms, it's very famous in Chinese history. There were these three warriors who took an oath in a peach garden to defend the realm from the rebels, basically. And as a kid, I used to play this video game called Romance of the Three Kingdoms 2. I played it a lot. I really liked it. It was a strategy game. Turns out Reed also played that game, unbeknownst to us when we started hanging out. And Owen played another game that used all the same characters called Dynasty Warriors. So one time, we all went to Reed's house to go play a team tournament. And I saw that Reed had the Three Kingdoms books, and I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know like anybody else knew about this stuff. Did you read those books? And we started talking about it, and it turned out that Reed was pretty into it, I was pretty into it, and Owen at least knew enough about it. So we started talking about the Peach Garden Oath, and then Owen made a long Facebook post where he found the oath, and he just basically inserted stuff about magic in place of, like, you know, defending the realm. It was like playing sealed deck tournaments and things like that. So from that day on, we just called ourselves the Peach Garden Oath. And we haven't actually made it to an actual peach garden, but we do believe in the oath.
If you want, I'll Google some locations for you. I'll find some good ones.
Awesome.
Because I think that needs to happen.
Yeah, Pro Tour Georgia, fingers crossed.
Yeah,
you know.
That's what you need.
Right.
So why is this team important to you? You've played with them so much over the past few years.
Well, I think the team is important to me and you know, to them, because we're important to each other. You know, I think the important thing is to remember is people sort of feel like, I've actually said people, like, had people say, you know, don't you think it's unfair that you guys, you know, you're the three best players, so you just make a team. And I'll remind people, I don't think we formed a team because we're three of the best players. I think we're three of the best players because we formed a team. you know, when we started playing together, Reed and Owen had very little to none of their Pro Tour success. I wasn't in the Hall of Fame. I hadn't made my top eight. I hadn't had my eight Grand Prix top eight season. We formed a team. We started playing together, talking about Magic all the time, hanging out all the time, and all of a sudden we all just killed it at everything. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think it's because we formed the team and because we worked together.
Yeah. And ate waffles together.
And ate waffles. What? Why does it keep coming back to waffles?
Thing. The waffles. Yeah, the waffle thing again.
Man.
I think I'm hungry.
I think
I'm just hungry.
It's a weird... Maria, it's 4:50 in the afternoon.
Megan, it's never too late for waffles, and you can put that on a t-shirt.
It's probably,
she's right about that.
It's probably already on one.
Probably.
I'll go Google it. All right, so to turn the tide of the conversation a little bit, you very recently in November came out publicly, and so yeah, we wanted to talk a little bit about what prompted you to do that, and how did you feel it was received, and why did you feel it was important?
Okay, sure. Yeah, so I guess it was probably around November 12th, 13th, something like that. I made an announcement on social media that I was gay. Basically, I had started telling people, I don't know, year and a half, somewhere in there before that. And for me, what prompted me to do it, it's just something I've been working towards. Like, I have sort of gotten in better shape. I've gotten healthier. I've become a lot more confident in myself, my appearance, and things like that. So I knew I was never really going to be happy while I was sort of like living in the closet. And so I was working towards it. And basically that morning, it was only a couple days after the election. And I don't know. I just felt so bad. It's hard to explain. And I was talking to a friend of mine, a black friend of mine, and he was sort of talking about how badly he felt. And he didn't even know I was gay at the time. And I sort of, it's hard to explain the feeling, almost like guilt, that like he had to go through this, and like publicly I don't really have the same burden as him, even though mentally I have this, I don't know, this weight. I couldn't really explain it. So I said, you know what, I'm just doing this today. I've just had enough of this. I had talked a lot about it with friends of mine. It's hard to explain. Like, logically, I wasn't embarrassed, and I wasn't ashamed, and I thought it would be fine, and, you know, I didn't think I'd be treated badly, but I was just scared. Maybe illogically, like I said, or, you know, maybe logically, it was just, it's one of those things, like, once you ring that bell, you can't unring it, and I'm a person who, I like to be in control of situations. Like, when I started telling people, it was like, I want to talk to you about something, don't tell anybody till I'm ready, don't tell anybody. And everybody respects my wishes, of course, and no problem there. But I wanted to sort of just be in control of everything. And I knew once I said something publicly, like, I was not going to be in control of how people behaved, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were a lot of things that weighed on me. Like, I just thought, just to name a few, first of all, when I was growing up, I would imagine had, you know, let's use John as an example because he's somebody I looked up to. Had John come out as gay, I would imagine that would have made things easier for me, aside from the fact he's my friend. You know, he's not gay, but if he had been and he had come out publicly, I think that would have made it easier for me. And this was something I struggled with. Like, maybe, like, I don't profess to think I'm important enough to really, whatever. I'm a pretty humble guy, but I understand the fact that it's reasonable to expect that if I were to come out publicly, somebody out there might feel better because of it. And I think that's a powerful thing. Like, you know, I really didn't want to do it before I was ready. But also, if there's a chance of helping somebody else who had been in my situation, that's certainly a huge plus. I thought the timing, particularly, like, I imagine if, you know, I come from a place of extreme privilege in the Magic community. You know what I mean? I have a lot of friends, and of all the most prominent people in Magic, both at Wizards and, you know, pro players and coverage, dealers, whatever, I have a personal relationship with almost anybody. And as hard as I felt things were for me, And, you know, it's sort of, it's all in my own head, of course, but as hard as I felt things were, I can only imagine how hard it would be for somebody else who doesn't have all the benefits I have and sort of like the social clout and friends and support I have publicly. So on some level, I just hope that I can make it easier on somebody else. In addition to, of course, like being able to, I'll tell you, I feel a lot better. It's really hard to just live a lie for a long, long time. And it's hard to be happy when you're doing that. Like, I remember when, you know, when I first was talking to my friend, you know, the first one I talked to, I sort of just started crying and I just said, I'm just so tired. Like, that's all I could really get out was, I'm just so tired. I'm just tired. Over and over, I'm tired, I'm tired, I'm tired. And that's what I mean. It's just exhausting to just sit there and, like, act how you think you're supposed to act and say things you think you're supposed to say rather than just saying and acting the truth, which I wish I had done a long time ago, but it's easier said than done, unfortunately. And as for the reaction, I couldn't even believe it. I was, like, stunned. I mean, I didn't, like I said, I tend to worry about stuff that I don't have that much control over. So yes, I worried, but in reality, I thought it would go over fine and I thought I wouldn't have a problem, but I didn't anticipate anything like what happened. I couldn't thank everybody enough. I mean, I had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people message me personally, message me directly, just telling me how much it meant, you know, how much it meant to them and, you know, telling me they loved me, people I haven't met, telling me how much they support me. I couldn't have even scripted something going better. I mean, so thank you to everybody. And honestly, yeah, my father was sitting at home just reading everything as it came in that day. And he told me, like, I saw him for Christmas. He told me it was the happiest day of his life. One of the happiest days of his life. He just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it either. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. So nice. You're making me emotional. I remember when you posted it on Twitter that day, I couldn't believe it. Like, it seemed so brave to me because, right, you're in this position of power. A lot of people know you and you're just like, you know what, you know, F it in a way. Like, this is who I am and I'm going to share it with everybody.
And even though you, like you said, you know a lot of people and you have a lot of great personal relationships, it's still difficult. Like you said, like you don't always know how someone's going to react and you can't control how people are going to react to that. So it, no matter what kind of position you're in, it takes a lot of courage. And I read your post multiple times that day because I was so happy for you.
Yeah.
I was so happy that you were in a place to be able to share that. So
thank you very much.
And it's true. I mean, like, just thinking of representation in the community, and some people don't know the value of representation, but there is so much, there's a tremendous amount of value in seeing somebody who is like you represented, not only as a player in the community, but a great player and somebody who's doing, you know, coverage now. It just means a lot.
Thank you. I do agree. I mean, anytime I've seen anybody come out in any sort of community, whether it's, you know, poker or entertainment or whatever, I always have such respect for them. I mean, every person, it mattered to me. Every time I saw it, I was I would have a sense of admiration and pride and hope, and I don't know. So I really appreciate you saying it, and I definitely also think it from my own experience.
So, I mean, this is an active discussion that people are having now about the LGBT community and how we think that Magic, like the people who create Magic and the people who play Magic, can make a better space or just better serve that particular community.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, and I want to be clear, like, a lot of people are super awesome. In all walks of life, but I think a lot of people, both in Magic and outside of Magic, would just be well served to just. I'll tell you this from my point of view. I had a talk with one of my close friends recently about this. something really simple, like words matter, okay? I'll tell you that right now. I remember stuff that got said. I remember stupid homophobic jokes people made when I was like 15 or 16. On the flip side, I remember having conversations when I was 13, 14, 15, 16 with family members, friends, people at tournaments where people would say things like, I guess like in defense of homosexuality or in defense of gay people in general or LGBT people. And these things matter. You might not think they matter and you might think a joke is a joke. It's not. It's hurtful. And it's something that people live with for years. I mean, they're whatever. Like, I don't want to go into, you know, you understand. Yeah, like, I'm not going to go into specific, like, whatever. But there are things people have said to me or said around me that, like, I think about to this day. And on the flip, you know, both good and bad. So I think people just need to be accepting. You know, that's another thing I hate. I hate people who say we need to be tolerant. Who wants to be tolerated? I don't. You know what I mean?
Like, certainly not. Yeah.
That's like, a really good point. I'll tolerate you.
Yeah.
No, I hate it. I would like to be accepted, respected, loved, enjoyed, embraced, whatever. I don't want to be tolerated. I think people just need to accept everybody for who they are. And I think people should do the best they can. And I certainly would never, you know, suggest anybody do anything before they're good and darn ready. But I think everybody, if I could give sort of advice to everyone, it would be do your best to accept yourself.
Yeah. And
I've never thought about it like that, but that's so true.
Yeah.
Who wants to be like, fine. Yeah, you're fine. I'll tolerate you. No.
And like the truth of it is, I actually don't know how many listeners know this. Some listeners do know this, but some don't. I consider myself a B in the alphabet soup. That sounds so bad. But that's what it is.
That's the only time I've ever heard you say it like that.
But like, you know, so I have a real personal connection to hearing you come out and just showing your bravery. And it makes me feel okay to be able to say something like that, especially, you know, since like people, a lot of times the bees, as I'm saying, are kind of regarded as like, okay, choose one. Get over yourself and pick one, you know. But so I just want to say, like, personally from me to you, it really meant a lot to see your message.
Thank you very much for saying so. I really appreciate it. I really do. And I don't want to give like a form answer, but it does mean a lot to me when people have come up to me and said, you know, things just like that. Like, you know, I feel more comfortable coming out now because of you and things like that. That really means a lot to me because I know the struggle. And not that, you know, not to say you're struggling right now or whatever. I just mean in general. I hope that I can help people like that because that would sort of, I guess, make it all worth it in my eyes easily.
Yeah.
So do you have any words of advice for LGBT players who might, like a word of advice who might be looking up to you?
Well, I guess my best advice is just that, you know, everybody's journey, I can only imagine everybody's journey through, you know, through their life of being what society perceives as different, despite, you know, this is just how I was born, how we're born. And everybody's journey is going to be different. So everybody should do things on their own terms and they should take every step as they're ready. But just know that, like, at least in me and others I've talked to, you have advocates out there in the community. And, you know, I personally think that the Magic community as a whole is a pretty great place. And I think it's getting greater and greater as time goes on. I think, you know, girls like you, certainly like promoting diversity and more sort of LGBT people in the community. I think Magic is headed in a great direction. So, I guess my advice would be stick with it, have faith in yourself and just take everything when you're ready. That's the best I got.
It sounds like, I mean, great, first of all. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like Magic has given you a lot over the years. Do you have anything that you think of as like, this is the biggest thing that I feel like Magic has given me or taught me?
I'm going to be honest with you. I've been playing Magic for so long, it almost feels like Magic is almost like a parent in a way. You know what I mean? It's just like something that's always been there. Like, I don't really remember being 10. And I don't really remember life before Magic. It was like, what did I do? I played Nintendo. So I sort of think Magic is just like an arm. It's just sort of part of me. It shaped everything about me. All my interactions with my friends. I mean, basically everything I've ever done, literally everything I've ever done in my life is either directly or indirectly because of Magic. This is like my quote on one of the sites, but it's true. And so that's why I'm repeating it. I can't imagine. Like if I hadn't, I've often had this conversation with either thought about it myself or talked about this to my parents for sure. Like what would have happened if I had the flu that day in seventh grade? Like where would my life be? I can't imagine my life if I hadn't picked up a Magic card. It's like Magic has literally given me everything. So yeah, I guess that's the answer. It has given me everything. I mean,
no, but that's like, that's incredible because yeah, like when you're, especially when you're so young, when you start playing,
yeah,
you would literally be a different person today.
And you know what, Megan? We've only been playing for 4 years, but can you imagine our life right now if we had never picked up a Magic card?
I literally can't.
Like, what would we be doing?
I have no idea.
It certainly wouldn't be as awesome as it is now.
No, it certainly would not be.
Maybe our Magic is just like a left hand at this point. It hasn't grown to full arm. But
call it a right hand.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
That's the hand I click with
it
on Magic Online.
It helps me get most things done. So if you could change one thing about Magic, what would you change?
Good question. One thing that was always sort of, I mean, that's not really fair. That's not Magic's fault. That's geography.
You want to invent teleportation? Yes, me too.
Exactly. Don't we all? It was sort of going in that vein. I mean, we used to talk about this more when we were younger. It was like we all would show up to these tournaments and like we all just have all these close friends and then you just go home.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like it's easier now. Everything's more connected. But, you know, I have friends in Europe and Asia who – people I really like and respect that I'd probably never see again, maybe once more in my life, which kind of stinks, you know. I don't know.
That works.
It's hard for me to lobby changing Magic. Magic Online, I wish they'd change that a bit.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You're not the first person to say that on the show.
Just slipped out.
So what is, for you, if you had like one tip to give people to up their game or go to the next level, what do you tell people who are like, oh, what's your best bit of advice for becoming a better player?
Well, it's kind of a cliche answer, but really, I mean, it's kind of a cliche question too.
We admit it.
We know.
But it's like, I think it's just the same thing. Magic is like anything else you do. You get out of it what you put into it. If you want to be great, like, okay, I live with Owen, okay? And the kid doesn't rest. I mean, he just plays and plays and plays and plays. And, you know, people just go like, I've seen this too. This is not even hyperbole. People just go like, I'm going to make it my goal to be the best Magic player in the world this year. And then it's like, no, you're not. You're just going to say it and hope it happens. You're not really making it your goal. You're not going to put in 60 hours a week of practice. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to find a network of people to talk about every stupid play you make all year. And you know, you're not going to give it what Owen gives it. So don't say it. If you want to try that, you should try it. But like I said, he's out there. That's what he's doing. So if you want to get to that level, you have to be prepared to do the same thing.
I love that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm the kind of person who's kind of actually militant and like with myself. If I say something, I damn well better do it.
Yeah.
You know? So like, I love
there.
That.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Just think of all the people that are out there actually practicing as hard as you say you're going to practice.
Yeah.
right, exactly.
So you've kind of gotten sort of a change in that you've been in the booth for some tournaments. How are you liking that new role?
I actually really enjoy it. I also will point out that I have by far the best job in the business, which is to do color for Marshall Sutcliffe. Marshall is so good at what he does. It makes it effortless. Like I've been in the booth a few times with other people and everybody, you know, everybody's good and whatever, but with Marshall I almost don't feel like I'm doing anything. I just sit there and have a conversation with Marshall, and at the end of the day, they tell me how great I did. And it really, credit to Marshall. He's so good at what he does. And I love it. Being in the booth with him, with Luis, Gabby, that whole crew, it's just great. And, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Marshall is like, I mean, he was he's been my only partner in the booth, and he made me look good, right? That's what I always say. I'm like, yeah, credit to Marshall.
Yeah, consummate professional, man.
It's true.
All right, so here's a question you didn't want us to ask you.
But we're going
that's not
to.
What I said. I just said I don't have a good answer.
The implication being, no. what's something people don't know about you? Any like strange hobbies outside of magic? Anything like that?
Honestly, I don't really have any strange hobbies. I used to play a lot of chess when I was a kid, but I never went to tournaments or anything like that. That's also not very strange. I'm looking around my apartment. I'm pretty good at Guitar Hero, the original one.
Sweet.
That's pretty awesome.
What's your favorite song to do on Guitar Hero?
Sweet Child of Mine.
Nice.
Are you playing guitar? Are you bass? What are you?
Wait, original Guitar Hero is just a guitar, right?
Yeah. Whoa.
Yeah, it's just guitar.
I had trouble imagining a time before you could play the drums.
This is the day before Rock Band came along, and then Guitar Hero was like, wait a second.
You're right. Oh my
I played Rock Band, but the drums were hard.
Yeah, that's true. They are. They're very difficult.
They're super hard.
I can't get my foot and my hands to coordinate. There's no communication between the two.
Like two different hands and a foot. It's too
exactly.
Much.
Like, no, thank you. I'm sorry.
I mean, they're so far apart. How are they supposed to talk in real time?
I don't know. I mean, in theory, your legs are there to help out, but
I don't know.
It doesn't get the job done.
Now I'm just imagining you and Owen playing some sweet, sweet Rock Band in your pad.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he doesn't play. He's too busy playing Magic.
Yeah, right?
He's living
the advice that you give.
That's how you get to be really good. Your friends are like, do you want to play Guitar Hero? And you're like, no.
No, I'm working.
I am playing Magic.
That is how.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and giving us a look into your magic career and your life. You're a fantastic guest.
We so appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you guys very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
We're so thrilled. Yeah. We're so thrilled to have you on. There's no other way to describe it.